Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we certainly can reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. My big wall calendar in the kitchen shows that Saturday, May 30th, is Memorial Day, but we observe it this year on Monday, May 25th. So I guess we could call this Memorial Week. In honor of and to commemorate Memorial Day, I'm going to read stories from the Good Old Days magazine and the Reminisce magazine about soldiers. This first one is entitled Alabama Ramblers in Korea. The ragtag group from home touched many hearts overseas. This was sent in by Dale Castile. When the 1,343rd Battalion left home for overseas, some of the boys carried their musical instruments with them, mostly for their own entertainment. After arriving in Korea, some started talking about getting a band together. So Jerry McGivney took hold of the reins and began getting everything together and lining everyone up. Jerry had a difficult time trying to get everyone together for practice because this music thing could not interfere with the regular duties. Fortunately, he never gave up, and we began to practice. This was the beginning of a group I was part of that became known as the Alabama Ramblers. Had it not been for Jerry McGivney's persistence, the Ramblers would never have existed. Because he was such a nice guy, he held many titles in the band. He was the manager, the booking agent, the driver, and the master of ceremonies. Soon the group recorded tapes and mailed them to Bob Donovan at radio station WJMW in Athens, Alabama. Bob was a good friend of the Ramblers, and he played the band's music on the radio. Band members also recorded messages on the tapes for their families at home. Many shows were performed in a variety of places, and the band really enjoyed entertaining. The crowd seemed to truly love this band and its music. Of course, we were the only show in town. It was the Alabama Ramblers or nothing. On occasion, the young band performed at field hospitals. The patients and nurses treated us like big stars. We knew that we had touched a heart when tears rolled down a patient's cheek. Perhaps the music and words had caused one to reminisce about loved ones or home, and to forget for just a moment about the danger that lurked around them. It was not difficult to gather a good crowd, no matter where the band performed. Everyone was hungry for any kind of entertainment, so the band was always welcomed. Often, the young musicians would arrive back at camp late at night or early the next morning, but we still had to fall out like the rest of the men and perform our assigned duties. The group may not have been a great band, but in it were some great entertainers. J.W. Hudson, a good singer, would sing the song he had written, Away From You, and it always went over well with the audience. The Proctor brothers, Stan White and Robert Catfish Allen, were also very good singers. Richard McLeay and Charles Adams always performed well. Fred B. Clem, the mandolin picker and comedian, would keep everyone laughing. Robert Grigsby played a mean harmonica, while James Price, the old boy from Missouri, played the steel guitar. George Naope, the only professional in the band, had a band or orchestra at home in Hawaii and played a role in one of Bing Crosby's movies. After a while, Hank Williams heard the tapes that had been sent to the radio station. The group received word that Hank liked our music and wanted us to appear on his show at the Grand Ole Opry. However, before the men could return home, Hank Williams was fired from the Opry, and he died shortly afterward. The members of the Alabama Ramblers really enjoyed performing for everyone. Perhaps we made a few people happy, touched a few hearts, and helped everyone forget about the war for a moment. If the band accomplished this, and I believe we did, then all of the work and time was worth it. I'm very proud to have been a small part of this band, whose members served their country with pride and honor, and who, with their music, made a few people smile. Just maybe somewhere across America, someone that served in Korea during this time can recall the old country band from North Alabama called the Alabama Ramblers, and smile. This story was entitled Alabama Ramblers in Korea by Dale Castile. Here are some items from the Reminisce magazine. This first short item is entitled Vietnam Through Your Eyes. April 30th, 2015 marks the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon and the official end of the conflict that claimed over 58,000 American lives and resulted in more than 150,000 wounded and some 1,600 missing in action. We asked readers to recount their memories and the stories of loved ones, and we found a shared eagerness to reflect on a difficult past. As reader Mary Lou Nolan noted in her tale of her brother Brad, quote, "He feels it is important that our young people know more about the Vietnam War," end quote. This item is entitled We Knew We Would Be Back Home One Day. This was written by Jean Stavis McKinley of Pueblo, Colorado. On September 17, 1967, my oldest brother, John E. Stavast, a career Air Force pilot, was shot down over Vietnam. Both he and his navigator parachuted into enemy territory and were captured. John was held in many different prisons, including the infamous Hanoi Hilton. He and his fellow POWs were tortured repeatedly, leading to severe injuries. Upon John's return, U.S. doctors discovered he had suffered several fractured vertebrae, fractures in both arms and legs, a skull fracture, and a broken jaw. At 6'4", John weighed only 145 pounds when he returned to the United States. My brother was released with other American POWs in March 1973. Our parents flew to California to join his wife, Shirley, to welcome John back to the States. Here in Pueblo, Colorado, our hometown, we had a great homecoming for him. He was met at the airport by the ROTC color guard and drill team, as well as by the marching band from his high school, Centennial. Many local dignitaries attended, and a week-long schedule of banquets and awards ceremonies welcomed him. In June 1980, Colonel John E. Stavast, U.S. Air Force, retired. He was a gifted and inspirational speaker in demand to talk about his experiences as a POW. He typically ended his talks by saying, "How wonderful it is to live in this great country. I'll never take my freedom for granted again. In my years in Hanoi prisons, I never met a POW whose faith in you or our president wavered. We all knew we would be back home one day. I'm proud of my association with so many fine, courageous men, and we are all very proud of you. God bless you all. Thanks also for the wonderful welcome home." And there are several pictures that accompany this article. Jean Stavis McKinley hugs her brother John at his Pueblo, Colorado homecoming, while his wife Shirley looks on. This was in April 1973. Jean, husband John, daughters Beth and Kathy, father John Sr., mother Ann, Shirley, and John celebrate being together again. And this was We Knew We Would Be Back Home One Day by Jean Stavis McKinley. This next story is entitled No Ordinary POW, sent in by Mary Lou Noland of Bradenton, Florida. My brother, Brad Smith, is my hero. He was an A-4 Skyhawk pilot serving on the USS Enterprise in the South China Sea. On March 25, 1966, targeting a bridge near the city of Vinh, Vietnam, he was shot down. He woke up 10 feet underwater, with a boat on each side piloted by angry enemy soldiers with AK-47s. Brad was a POW for 6 years and 11 months. He was forced to march barefoot through the jungle and rice paddies to Hanoi. Guards beat him with rifle butts, and villagers hit him with clubs and rocks. There were fake executions in front of firing squads where you never knew. At Hanoi Hilton, they made him pay for his resistance to give them any military information and false confessions, for propaganda purposes, by using cruel, sadistic forms of torture. The food? He and other POWs were fed wormy bread, weeds, bugs, monkeys, rats, you name it. If it had protein, they ate it. Quote, "You had to hold your nose and try not to think about it," Brad told me. He weighed 175 pounds when he was shot down and lost 60 pounds in 6 months. The POW network within the prison made a difference. They had a communication system, tap codes, visual codes, plus teams who memorized names and everything that came in or out of the cell block. They were able to support one another in times of torture. Brad said, "The North Vietnamese never figured out all the stuff we knew. For 5 years, we didn't know whether Brad was dead or alive. I prayed for him daily." Then a picture appeared in a French newspaper showing him being checked by North Vietnamese doctors. It was a propaganda picture trying to show the prisoners were being cared for. Still, I knew he was alive and that my prayers were being answered. On February 12, 1973, the cell door flew open. The guards walked in with boxes of shoes, jackets, and pants. "These are our going-home clothes," we thought. "We hoped," Brad said. The next morning, the POWs were bused to a large airfield where they saw their plane, an Air Force C-141 Starlifter, on approach. It was all gray with a great big American flag painted on the tail, he said. Brad was the first POW to arrive in Jacksonville, Florida, and our family greeted him at the base hospital. "This was the biggest miracle I had ever experienced in my lifetime." After his return, Brad got back into the cockpit of a Navy fighter and served another 12 years. "He was a POW, but he is not a prisoner to what happened to him," he said. "They ruined nearly 7 years of my life, but it was not my desire to carry that back home and let it ruin the rest of my life." Today, he is asked to speak to veterans groups, schools, and numerous organizations, and he humbly tries to fulfill every request. "I call him my hero, not just for all he went through in the war, but for the kind of man he is." And that very moving article was entitled "No Ordinary POW," written by Mary Lou Noland of Bradenton, Florida. This next story is entitled "She Found a Way to Help." This was sent in by Kenneth Goodman of Arroyo Grande, California. Daegu, Korea, 1951. The convoy of trucks was on a narrow dirt road, passing more abandoned rice paddies. I was truly saddened at the sight of the Koreans trudging south. The people were carrying all that they possessed on their backs. Little boys and girls went from person to person like they were looking for their mamas, tears rolling off their faces. I had to hide my tears. My little brother and sister, Gary and Gail, could have been one of them. The convoy commander called a halt, and soon all the GIs were on the ground, opening little boxes of rations. As people saw that we were starting to eat, boys and girls came begging. I handed my half-pint tin of sausage to some wide-eyed little girl. Other GIs were doing the same. None of the GIs ate a thing. When we got ready to leave, I found a 10-year-old boy sitting in my seat. He said in broken English that he wanted to be our houseboy. I told him we had no house and that he could not ride with us. The driver and I finally got him down after a little struggle, and he went off crying. My heart broke. In every letter I wrote to my mom and my girlfriend Ruth, I told them about the orphan children because it was a burden on my heart. Ruth wrote back asking what she could do to help. I told her I didn't know, only that they needed warm clothes and canned food. Ruth went to the U.S. Air Force base outside Yuma, Arizona, to see a chaplain and ask for assistance. The chaplain was able to find where I was and discovered an orphanage being set up. Meanwhile, Ruth's church congregation gathered clothes and canned food. One afternoon, a Jeep pulled up in our rest area, and a captain ordered me into the back. Thinking I was in trouble, I squeezed in beside two very large boxes. After an hour-long drive, we pulled over next to two little huts. The captain said, "Do you know who Ruth French is?" Dumbstruck, I said, "Yes, sir, Ruth is my girlfriend." The captain said, "She sent these boxes, and now you get to give out what's inside." I opened the boxes and saw the clothes. All the boys and girls ran up to me, yelling, laughing, and jumping about. I had tears of happiness rolling down my cheeks as I pulled out sweaters, pants, coats. The little guys showed one another the treasure they had, finding the cans of meat and fruit and things like gloves and socks. After the clothes were all gone, the captain, a chaplain, said to me, "You did an excellent job. I want to thank you and Ruth from the children and from me." I was so happy for the kids, and I was very much in love with a girl whose heart was as big as the world. This was entitled "She Found a Way to Help," sent in by Kenneth Goodman of Arroyo Grande, California. Here's a small item entitled "A Flag Sewn with Courage." This was sent in by Leslie Wheeler of Rockland, California. Over 70 years ago, I was a rifle-carrying infantry sergeant in France, Germany, and Austria. Among the few war souvenirs I kept, one reminds me of courage and bravery seldom equaled. In November of 1944, we were assigned the dangerous task of clearing out the enemy troops who remained after others had evacuated. As we carefully walked down the main street, a little old Hausfrau came out and offered me an item that could have brought her instant death had she been discovered. Working at night, her home surrounded by Nazi troops, she had ripped out a swath of a large swastika flag. On the back, she had sewn six white stripes and then cut out and attached 48 small stars. With tears in her eyes, she thanked me for helping to bring freedom from the years of terror under Hitler's reign of oppression. And there's a picture of Leslie Wheeler proudly displaying his unconventional American flag. This was "A Flag Sewn with Courage" by Leslie Wheeler. This next story from the Good Old Days magazine reflects the lighter side of a soldier's life. It's entitled "Get Me to the Church on Time." Her 15 minutes were rapidly disappearing. This was sent in by Martha Tullis. We were walking along one evening in Northampton, Massachusetts, my boyfriend Roy and I, when suddenly he said, "Let's get married." Even though I was madly crazy about him, I was so startled that I laughed. "Are you serious?" We went into a coffee shop and discussed it over pumpkin pie. There were such obstacles. After Pearl Harbor, he had signed up for a Navy Reserve program, though he was still a student at Williams College. Because he was in that program, he was not allowed to be married until he became an officer. Also, I was a student at Smith, and Smith did not permit students to be married either. Was a secret wedding possible? No, we ruled that out. So we waited. A wedding day seemed remote. Of course, the bigger question was if we would even have a life together after the war, but we never talked about that. After we both graduated, Roy went into flight training. He would be a naval cadet for some time and still not permitted to get married. I went home to Rye, New York, and started working as a newspaper reporter for the Port Chester, New York Daily Item. I wrote articles about buying war bonds, growing victory gardens, and saving gasoline. It was harder to write about the wounded, missing, or killed in action. Sometimes they were boys I had known in Rye High School. Roy and I wrote letters to each other every day. After training in New Hampshire and Chapel Hill, North Carolina, he was given a short leave. He came home to nearby Mount Vernon and put a sparkling diamond on my finger. Then he was stationed at the Naval Air Base in Corpus Christi, Texas, for the final round of flight time. I continued to write for the item, covering school board meetings and city councils. Life on the home front had to go on. At last, after many months, Roy sent for me. When I boarded the train in New York, I was dismayed, not an empty seat in sight. The train was filled with Army men for the most part. I walked through car after car, carrying my small suitcase. Finally, I set it down and sat on top of it. Luckily, after a while, a nice GI, which stood for government issue, squeezed over on his seat and made room for me. I could tell him where I was going, but he could not discuss his destination. I guessed he was headed overseas and off to the war. That cloud of worry always hung over us in those days, no matter where we were or what we were doing. When the train pulled into Corpus Christi, I flew into Roy's arms for a moment of complete joy. "As soon as the weather clears, we will finish our flight hours," he promised me. So there was more waiting, but not for long. I spent the next few days in a hotel room with other girls who were waiting to be married, too. I asked a girl named Ruth to stand up for me at my wedding, and Roy asked another pilot to be his best man. The next day we were all to be married in the chapel on the naval base, all of us. The men would no longer be cadets, but would be commissioned as officers and thus permitted to marry. The schedule in the chapel was packed solid with weddings. We were given 15 minutes each. The day after that, our husbands had orders to travel elsewhere. Roy was to leave for Florida, but now I could be with him. The next morning, I slipped on my new green and white silk dress and left the hotel on foot. I'd promised Roy I'd go to a nearby cleaner's to pick up his dress uniform. Then I would hurry to the base. But there was a long line at the cleaner's. My stomach was doing somersaults. Our start time was 10:15. I should have left sooner. Finally, I got the uniform, and then I rushed off to the base. But there were busy streets to cross and traffic to wait on. At last, I ran up to the entrance. But oh my gosh, I was 5 minutes late already. We'd have to have a 10-minute wedding. "Please let me in," I panted, hoisting the uniform onto my shoulder. "I'm due to get married." "Well now, what do you want to do that for?" The guard grinned and sank lazily onto a stool. "Pretty girl like you, what's your hurry?" "I'm serious," I exploded. Then I explained it to him. I glanced at my watch. Only 8 minutes left. Was I going to miss my own wedding? "You have to let me in," I just about shouted. "Well, okay, but if you change your mind..." He swung open the gate and I rushed through it. "The chapel's down there on your left," he called after me. I raced toward it, but by the time I reached it, our 15 minutes were mostly gone. I was almost in tears. No wedding, no getting married today. The next couple were poised to begin their ceremony. The chapel was filled with their family and friends who happened to live nearby. I was in despair. Roy hugged me tight, and then he stepped back and grinned. "Good news. The next couple is going to share their 15 minutes with us." Oh, happy day. But there was no time for the dress uniform. We hurried up the aisle with Ruth and the best man. The minister quickly spoke the magic words in front of all these strangers, and hooray, we were man and wife. That was followed by a big kiss from Roy, and 63 years of a wonderfully happy marriage, and a lesson I'd tried to learn about being on time. And this was Get Me to the Church on Time by Martha Tallis. Here are a couple of military stories from the Reminisce magazine in the I Was So Embarrassed section. This first one's entitled Going Commando. I was in Korea in the summer of 1952, laying communication lines between infantry and artillery units. One day, our jeep came upon a small river, too long to stretch our wire to the nearest bridge. Because I had just learned to swim a few months earlier, I was elected to paddle across the river with the wire strapped to my back. I stripped to my underwear and shoved my clothes into my steel helmet, thinking I would float it across and be dressed by the time the others arrived from the bridge. I thought wrong. I was more than halfway across the river when the bundle got so wet and heavy I had to either let it go or drown with it. When the jeep reached me on the other side, I was standing in my underwear with the box of wire still strapped to my back. The job was done, and no one would ever let me forget it. This was sent in by Jim Henry of Titusville, Florida. And this other story, entitled A Poor Cattle Call, was sent in by Jean McRae of Savannah, Georgia. In 1968, my husband was stationed with the U.S. Air Force in Thailand, and I was left home with our three children, ages 4, 5, and 6. One lovely fall day, I decided to take the kids to the zoo in Fort Worth, Texas. Wandering past the cages, we came upon a large animal with big horns that I instantly recognized as a water buffalo. My husband had sent home photos of these animals, telling tales of how vital they were to the Thai people's daily lives. They carried heavy burdens, helped plow the fields, and were all around prized possessions. As I explained all this to my kids, they seemed genuinely interested in what I was telling them. As we started moving on to the next cage, we passed a lone gentleman sitting on a nearby bench. "Excuse me, ma'am," he said. "I could not help but overhear what you were saying about that large animal. I just thought you should know that you were looking at a Texas longhorn." I don't think my children ever believed me about anything again. This was A Poor Cattle Call by Jean McRae. Well, I hope you've had a very enjoyable Memorial Day, both observed as well as official. And I hope you find many bargains at the Memorial Day sales that are going on around town. You've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories.